Welcome to the talk for this week. And this week we're going to be looking at the Asalayana Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya number 93, I believe. And I've got an extra copy of the Majjhima here if anyone wants one. So the Asalayana Sutta, continuing the theme of the chapter that chapter from Brahmins that we've been going through, and one of the features of the Majjhima Nikaya in terms of its structure is that the structured in groups of 10 suttas or vagga, and some of those suttas being structured according to literary features like possessing similes or things like that. But this group in the middle of them, middle of the Majjhima Nikaya, we have one on the wanderers, one on the householders, on the bhikkhus, on kings, and on the Brahmins. So being structured according to groups of people. And of course being different kind of discourses, showing the Buddha in dialogue with various people in his time. And as so many of the suttas, largely being an example of interfaith dialogue, is what we actually have. Okay, Sutta Central gives the following parallels for the Asalayana Sutta, one in the Majjhima Agama, one independent sutta, in the Majjhima Agama style sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and one in the Ekottara Agama. So the online version that we'll be using today is from Google Books, and they have most of the Majjhima Nikaya has been obviously made available by Wisdom Publications for Google to put online, which is good. So I'm not sure if it has the whole text on there, we'll find out as we go. Okay, so I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove out of Indiga's Park. Now at that time, 500 Brahmins from diverse provinces were staying in Savati for some business or other. The Brahmins thought, this recluse Gotama describes purification for all four castes. Who is there to dispute with him about this assertion? So of course this being fundamental to the Brahmanical ideology which they were trying to develop and sustain at the time, that purification is something that belongs to the Brahmins alone. So this kind of idea that they constitute a almost like a chosen people or a special class. Now on that occasion, a Brahmin student named Asalayana was staying at Savati, young, shaven-headed. So the Brahmin students were often depicted as being shaven-headed, which is kind of interesting because they also use shaven-headed as a word of abuse for ascetics. But the word for shaven-headed here is vuttasiro, and when they use it as a term of abuse is a mundaka. So I wonder whether there's a difference there, whether it actually means the same thing. I haven't researched that particular point. There may be some kind of difference in what's actually happening there. Anyway. Young, shaven-headed, 16 years old, a master of the three Vedas with their vocabularies, liturgy, phonology and etymology, with the histories as a fifth, skilled in philology and grammar. He was fully versed in natural philosophy and in the marks of a great man. So by now we should be familiar with this standard list of the Vedic literature of the Buddha's time. Tienang Vedanam Paragu Sanigandha Uke Dubhanam Sakara Pabhedanam Itihasa Panchamanam Padako Veyakarno Lokayata Mahapurisa Lakanam Anavayo Lakanesu Anavayo. So I won't go over that because unless any questions. Okay, so Asalayana is staying here. And the Brahmins thought he will be able to dispute with the recluse Gotama about this assertion. Kind of interesting that all the senior Brahmin teachers wanted to get this young 16-year-old kid to go and do their dirty work for them, yeah? Maybe they thought that he was going to be a bit feisty, you know, the old guys may be a bit kind of more tired or not so energetic, I don't know. Or maybe they just thought he was going to be a bit gullible and they'd be able to enjoy watching him getting torn apart by the Buddha, I don't know. Stranger things have happened. I'm just wondering, other information about Asalayana? Okay, so some background information on Asalayana. Apart from most of it's just from the current sutta. Buddhaghosa says that Asalayana's, it's in the commentary, that Asalayana became a devoted follower of the faith and built a chaitya in his own residence for worship, and that all his descendants, down to Buddhaghosa's day, built similar chaityas in their homes. That's kind of interesting, but also chaitya here probably means shrine rather than stupa. But interesting as a record of the practice of building shrines in homes. Asalayana was probably identified with the father of Mahakotpita, his wife being Chandavati. There's however one difficulty with the theory. Mahakotpita said he was won over to the faith after hearing the same sermon of the Buddha as converted his father, Yadame Pitarang Buddha Vinayi Subsabha Sudhiya. It's unlikely if the identification be correct, this refers to the Asalayana Sutta, because at that time Asalayana was only 16 years old. Huh. So, possibly the father of Mahakotpita, one of the great disciples of the Buddha. I didn't know that. So the Brahmins went to him and said, Master Asalayana, this precludes Gotama, describes purification for all the four castes. Let Master Asalayana come and dispute with the recluse Gotama about this assertion. When this was said, Asalayana replied, so the recluse Gotama is one who speaks the Dhamma. Now those who speak Dhamma are difficult to dispute with. I am not able to dispute with the recluse Gotama about this assertion. Humility there, reminding of the some of the later suttas like the Vimalakirti Sutra, where the all the great arahants and reluctant to go and speak with Vimalakirti, the Bodhisattva, because they know that he's going to refute all of their ideas, even though he just asks the monks to come and see him because he's sick, but they're just too scared to go and see him. Then they keep encouraging a second time. And they say that the training of a wanderer has been completed by Master Asalayana, which is a somewhat curious statement, to which the footnote says, they mean by that, having studied the three mantras, you've three Vedas, you've trained in the mantras by which those who go forth undertake their going forth for the mantras they maintain after they've gone forth. You've practiced their mode of conduct, therefore you will not be defeated. Okay, so it seems to be saying that he's completed the training which those who would become wanderers as Brahmins would complete before going off to do their training. Charitang ko panabhota salayanena paribhajakam. Interesting, charitang. Okay, for the second time he said, well, no, it's not going to be easy. And third time, they keep on encouraging him and add the following argument: let not the master Asalayana be defeated without even having fought the battle. Ayudha parajitam. So giving some idea of the state of mind that they're approaching this debate in, not as an inquiry for truth but as a battle to be won. And noticing the word here is the for the battle or defeat here in the battle is parajitam, parajayi. Okay, so this usually being connected with the vinaya offence of parajika or defeat. There's some dispute about the etymology, but that's the most normal etymology of it. When this was said, Brahman student Asalayana replied, surely, sirs, I am not getting through to you when I say the recluse Gotama is one who speaks the Dhamma. Now those who speak the Dhamma are difficult to dispute with you. I'm not able to dispute with him about this assertion. Still, sirs, at your bidding, I will go. So he knows he's going to be defeated, but he's going to go anyway. So then he went with a large number of Brahmins to the Buddha, exchanged greetings. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, They sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, the Brahmins say this, Brahmins are the highest caste, those of any other caste are inferior, Brahmins are the fairest caste, those of any other caste are dark. Only Brahmins are purified, not non-Brahmins. Brahmins alone are the sons of Brahma, the offsprings of Brahma, born of his mouth, born of Brahma, created by Brahma, heirs of Brahma. What does Master Gotama say about that? Well, he's pretty straightforward about it all, isn't it? Yeah? None of this wishy-washy tact business, you know. There's just, that's what we say. Just deal with it. And kind of surprising, eh? You find these kinds of things still today, you know. Like, driving in a taxi a number of years ago, there was this Muslim fellow driving the taxi who could have quite cheerfully told me that anyone who wasn't Muslim was going to go to hell, you know. And that's an interesting bit of tidbit to enjoy in the journey. When people say these kinds of things all the time, I was just quite struck when I was looking at this thing about, because the basic theme of this sutta is about, well, this kind of prejudice, you know. Can one group of people be regarded as intrinsically better than others? And I was struck when this morning, just reading in the Guardian in Germany, there's a big controversy right now. Again, the German Chancellor asserts that multiculturalism has failed and is stirring up the anti-immigration debate. People in Germany are calling for a halt of Turkish and Arabic immigration. 55% of Germans believed Arabs are an unpleasant people. Bit of a worry, isn't it? One third of Germans believed the country was overrun by foreigners. And this former central banker had published a highly controversial book in which he accused Muslim immigrants of lowering the intelligence of German society. Yes, well, what to say? And of course, the interesting thing with all of these things is that the rhetoric goes on. You know, our country's being overrun by immigrants, right? The rhetoric goes on and on and on and on. Actually, the people in the economics department are saying, well, we actually lack 400,000 skilled workers, and it's holding our economy back. And if we can get more immigration, then our economy will be better. And so there's this whole thing. With the reality of the situation is so far from these ideas that people have, which is exactly the situation in the Asalayana Sutta, as we'll see, where he is repeatedly refuted by the Buddha, but just keeps on going with his arguments. Although, given his due, he's already said, he already knows from the beginning that he can't really defeat the Buddha, yeah? So he's just being stubborn to play the game, which, okay, I can understand that. But then the other thing today is there's big problems in the States with people bashing gays again. So there's been, of course, another very virulent form of this discrimination. You know, we're not so familiar with the reason I'm bringing these up is we're not so familiar with the caste claims and the claims that the Brahmins are superior and everyone else is inferior. That's not our particular issue. It is in India. If you're Indian, it still is very much so, yeah. But for us, it's not what is, you know, that's not how we experience discrimination and inequality, but it takes its various different forms. So there's been some terrible homophobic attacks in America just recently. Much of it in New York, people being bashed, kidnapped, beaten, whipped and burnt. And that's part of a series of incidents, what's been going on. And some of the sentiments of the Republican leaders sort of coming out and saying things like, gay people shouldn't become teachers. So it's important to bear that in mind when we're looking at suttas like this, that the context is shifted. So, but the basic way that human minds work and the way that we use, notice the way that the Brahmins are doing is that they use culture. in a sense, to create their inequality. So for them, their culture comes from their mastery of the Vedas, they're the educated class, they're literate, they know. We have our ancient... Who are you? Well, of course, the reason they know is because they've monopolized it and they haven't let anyone else study it, right? But that's still the fact. They're the elite, the literary elite. And there's no doubt that there is a value to that, you know, quite obviously. The Vedic culture has provided a lot of value for Indian society, yeah? Even though what we're looking at here is some of the statements that we find most offensive, but there are, of course, many other things within the Vedic culture which are not, which are, you know, perfectly very good teachings. So when we're reading these kinds of texts, it's very important that we understand what's the underlying principles that's involved, because the direct arguments may be not so relevant, but the underlying principles, the manner in which the Buddha engages with Asalayana, is still very worth understanding. Okay, so the Buddha then proceeds with a series of responses to Asalayana's claim. And so we'll come back to that in just a minute, but I'll just briefly look at a couple of things first. One is the claim that he makes in Pali. Okay, so Brahmins are the Septa, the highest class, here being Septa, or the best class, and the other classes are Hina, okay, as in Hina Yana. Alright? Hino anyo varno. Brahmano va sukko. Okay, the bright or white caste. Ganho anyo varno. And so there's almost certainly a racial background to that, even though it wasn't very prominent in India at that time. But historically, the Brahmins are probably established by a northern community, gradually moved in to India and became established in the upper classes in India, while the lower classes were the native population who tended to be darker skinned. I mean, that's referring to a much earlier time than the time of the Buddha, but it's still true to some degree today. The only Brahmins can be purified, not non-Brahmins. Brahmins are the sons of Brahman, yeah? Okay, born of the offspring of Brahman, born of his mouth, Mukato Jata, Brahmaja, born of Jata, made by Jata, and the heirs, born by Brahma, made by Brahma, and the heirs of Brahma. So the phrase here is a little bit similar to the chant, if you're familiar with the chant on the ownership of Kama in Buddhism, Kama Dayado, Kama Yoni, Kama Bandhu, Kama Patisarano, and it's quite similar, Kama Brahma Dayada, and so on. So this is one of the things that the Buddha, of course, always said, is that we're actually born of our Kama and not born of Brahma. So here, obviously, this is a doctrine which can be interpreted in a literal sense as well as in a spiritual sense. So the Buddha plays on this distinction. Okay. Oh, and before we go on, just briefly here, here's Analio's essay. Nothing too interesting here, but just a comment on the individual translation of the sutta, the T71. So when you're identifying these things, if you see the sutra number, Taisho 71, the Madhyama Agama in the Taisho is Madhyama 26. Okay? So you have Madhyama Agama is Taisho 26, and so Madhyama MA151 is the 151st sutta inside the book of Madhyama 26, of Taisho 26. Okay? Following Taisho 26, there's a whole series of individual suttas leading up to the between there and the Sangyutta, which I think is 99. So Taisho 71 is one of those individual sutras. Okay, so whereas Taisho 26, the Majjhima Agama, has 200 and something sutras, and this is just one sutta, Taisho 71. Translated by Dharma Raksha, between 317 to 420 AD, meaning, not quite certain of the dates, but almost all the major sutra, agama and vinaya translations were around the latter part of this period, around 420. Yeah? So if it was earlier, then quite possible it was an individual sutta that was translated a little bit earlier than the actual major Agama collection, which may or may not mean it comes from an earlier source text. It may come from exactly the same source text in India. In some cases with Mahayana sutras, you find that there are different versions translated several hundred years apart in China. So maybe one translated in 300 AD, another one in 500, another one in 700 or something like that. And they'll have quite strong differences, which show that it's not just the translation that differ, but the actual Indic source text always also differs as well. So they were still evolving. Whether that's the case here or not is hard to say. But one of the problems being that the individual sutras, we usually have no idea what the school of them was, the school affiliation. It's hard enough to work out what the school affiliation is, even of the major agamas, much less the individual sutras. Which, of course, shows how similar they are. Okay. So, a slight difference in where the Brahmins came from. According to the Pali, they came from various different parts of India, Nanavir Rajaka. According to the Madhyam Agama, they come from Kosala. And the individual sutra explicitly mentions that Asalayana and the other Brahmins did not pay homage to the Buddha. Okay, so now back to the Buddha's response. Now, Asalayana Brahmin women are seen having their periods, becoming pregnant, giving birth, and giving suck. And yet those Brahmins, though born from the womb, say thus, Brahmins are the highest caste. Brahmins alone are the sons of Brahma, offspring of Brahma, born of his mouth, born of Brahma, created by Brahma, heirs of Brahma. So, pretty straightforward argument there. I mean, obviously, normally you'd get around that these days by saying, well, it's spiritually they're born of Brahma. I mean literally that they're born of Brahma, but there's a kind of a spiritual birth. So that's a kind of another argument in what sense that's meant. It seems hard to imagine that anybody ever really meant that they were literally born from Brahma, since the evidence presented here by the Buddha would have probably been fairly obvious to most people. But in a sense, I guess what the Buddha's doing here is he's pressing. Well, you know, obviously this isn't true in a literal sense, okay? So what are you talking about, yeah? So then sort of pressing him to, well, further, what do you mean by this? I mean, in a sense, one of the problems is you can say all you like, we're spiritually the heirs of Brahma, okay? But it's quite a different thing. Like if somebody's a son of a mother, well, you know, you can see the mother's pregnant and then you can see she gives birth, and, you know, it's a meaningful thing. But once you start saying, we're spiritually the sons of Brahma, it becomes a much more difficult claim to ascertain. So Asalayana doesn't really take up the challenge here. Although Master Gotama says, thus, still the Brahmins think Brahmins are the highest caste and so on and are the heirs of Brahma. So Asalayana simply stubbornly sticking to his views, not really engaging with the Buddha in his argument. Which again might possibly, you could imagine it comes from his state of mind when he first approached the Buddha. He knows he can't win, so he'll just won't even bother trying too hard. Anyway, okay, next part is quite interesting. What do you think, Asalayana? Have you heard that in Yona and Cambodia, that is in Greece and Cambodia, and in other outland countries, there are only two castes, masters and slaves, and that masters become slaves and slaves masters, so I've heard. Then on the strength of what argument or the support of what authority do Brahmins in this case say thus? Brahmins are the highest caste and so on, and are the heirs of Brahma. And Asalayana then merely repeats his own statement. So obviously the point the Buddha here making, and this is a point to argue against Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, that through knowing and understanding what other cultures are like and what they're about, then that gives you a new perspective on understanding your own culture. Yeah, you realise actually, you know, we're not trapped in this way of being. It doesn't have to be like this. Yeah, and when you're very insular and you only look into your own world, it must be like this. This is the only way it can be. But well, actually, over there they do it quite differently, and, you know, they're kind of going okay. I mean, they conquered half of India, so they can't be too bad. So this is an interesting reference, and you know, a very basic argument for multiculturalism, but also interesting historically. It's quite an unusual reference, and the mention of Iona here. Iona is from Ionia, is one of the regions of Greece. It's the normal Iona is the normal Indian term for Greek. Cambodia is of course the same word as what we know of today as Cambodia. What it referred to here is perhaps not quite so clear. Cambodia is a region to the northwest of the Indian Middle Country. Okay, so it's in the northwest. Now the reference to masters and slaves is also interesting, because the when the Greek ambassador Megasthenes was in the court of Chandragupta, the Mauryan emperor, about 100 years after the Buddha, he wrote his descriptions of Indian culture at the time, and he said that India didn't have any slaves. Okay, so this is interesting that they see these two descriptions of each other's country, the Indian's perspective of the Greeks and the Greeks' perspective of the Indians. Yeah, so the Greeks are saying, well, the Indians didn't have any slaves. And the Indians are saying that the Greeks only had masters and slaves, only the two castes. Yeah, which is kind of interesting. And probably representing the situation that the practice of slavery was much more widespread, and there was a much kind of stronger and more oppressive slavery system in the West than there was in India. I mean, obviously there were slaves in India, they were bonded servants in Dasa at all times, but more, you know, they weren't really slaves in the same sense that we think of slaves today in a modern time. Yeah, they're basically bonded labourers, and it seems often that they were treated quite well. I mean, you hear all these kind of stories of slaves, say one of the Jataka stories where one of the slaves girl is going off on a picnic with her friends, and the mistress of the house says, oh well, why don't you take my valuable necklace with you, and you can, you know, make you look pretty when you go on the picnic, you know. So obviously it's not something that, you know, we'd think of if you're thinking about someone, their relationship to their slave. So the reference here is a bit controversial, because one of the very few references to Greece in the Pali Canon, and of course there wasn't, historically we don't know of a strong Greek presence in India until at least 100 years after the Buddha, with the invasion of Alexander, and it's doubtful even at that time whether perhaps not all that much cultural interchange happening at that time, apart from hitting each other with swords and so on. But from that time, there was established more of a Greek presence, and some cities in the far northwest, and then later on, the Bactrian kingdoms and the large part of the northwest of India was under Greek control for hundreds of years. So there's no problem with Greek influence or knowledge of Greek culture in India from a period starting a couple of hundred years after the Buddha, but there's no real concrete evidence of that in the time of the Buddha itself. So quite a lot of the Western scholars argue that shows that this must be a later passage, this argument about the Greek culture, which is possible. It's also, of course, quite possible that they simply had some vague knowledge of cultures in Greece and elsewhere before that time of the invasions. So.
Surely that time was something with invading it. It must have been some sort of exchange.
Well, yeah. Well, that's very true. Yeah. Ever since the Indus Valley, they'd been trading with Mesopotamia and so on. The interesting thing is why it says Greek rather than say Persians or Babylonians. Yeah. I mean, Greece is a long way from India. So that would seem to only really make sense, you know, after the period of the expansion of the Greek Empire, when Alexander came over, then the Greeks really were there. But anyway, this is...
Maybe this is the most exotic example.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. So, but that the mention of the Greeks is found in the other suttas, both the other parallels. The individual translation also says that by dint of a good conduct, a slave can become a free man. A free man who undertakes evil conduct may end up having to sell himself as a slave. So the okay, so on Yona and Cambodia, Cambodia is one of the 16 Indian countries. I don't know much about it. It would be interesting to know whether that's an accurate description of their society. I'm not sure about that. So it seems to be the Madhyama Agama version also agrees in mentioning of Yona and Cambodia, whereas the individual translation speaks of. Do you know what that means, Aya? Can you read that?
What
is country? What's it? What is it again? Say it again?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yutu
Guo.
Yutu Guo. Good. I mean, Guo is a country, yeah. It could be, or it could be, yeah, I mean, I'm wondering whether it's standing for Yona, whether it could be a phonetic, it's hard to say. In Sanskrit is Yavana, it doesn't sound very much like it.
I think it's the sound.
It's probably a phonetic, yeah? So Guo being one of the nice Chinese characters, it's the word for country, and gives you how Chinese thought of their country. It's locked up in a big box with a big wall all around it. Okay, so this is a phonetic transcription of the classical Chinese pronunciation. Okay, next argument. What do you think, Asalayana? Suppose a noble were to kill living beings, take what is not given, misconduct himself in sensual pleasures, speak falsely, speak maliciously, speak harshly, gossip, be covetous, have a mind of ill will, and hold the wrong view. On the dissolution of the body after death, would only he be likely to appear in a state of deprivation and an unhappy destiny and perdition even in hell and not a Brahman? So this is for the Katiyas, the worker, the Vesa, and the merchants, the Vesa, and the workers, the Suddhas. So this being, of course, the 10 pathways of wholesome or unwholesome action, and being this is a fairly standard Buddhist argument found elsewhere in the Majjhima Nikaya and Majjhima 84 saying that the results of karma are essentially similar, independent of what caste that you belong to. And in this time, for the first time, Asalayana actually gives a sensible response. No, Master Gotama, whether a noble, a kshatriya, a brahman, a vesa, or a worker, all of those four castes who kill living beings and so on after death are likely to appear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Then, on the strength of what argument or with what authority do the Brahmins say that Brahmins are the highest caste? And Asalayana still sticks with his view. Though Master Gotama says this, still Brahmins say we are the highest caste. Okay, so then it gives the reverse argument. If they keep the 10 pathways of wholesome action, then they're likely to appear in heaven. And then the same kind of response. Then talking about not so much behaviour, but about mental cultivation. Is only a Brahman capable of developing a mind of loving kindness without hostility, without ill will, and not a noble, a kshatriya, a worker, a vesa, or a merchant, or a worker, a sudha? And of course the answer is that anybody can develop a mind of loving kindness. So again, what are you saying? What's your argument? And he still sticks by it. He says, well, what do you think, Asalayana? Is only a Brahmin capable of taking a loofah and bath powder? Anyone knows what a loofah is?
It's for bathing.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a
That's right, yeah. It's a dried, fibery, spongy thing. It's scrubbing yourself when you're bathing. Yeah, well, traditionally, so I think it's just the sponge. I think the stick is a modern innovation, yeah. It's from a gourd, is it?
Yeah.
Huh. Oh, I don't know what it was. I thought it was a sea thing, but it's a gourd. Oh. Going to the river and washing off dirt, dust and dirt. So is only a Brahmin capable of having a bath and not a kshatriya and so on. This, of course, referring to the argument of purification through bathing, which is a big part of the Brahmanical tradition. Salayana admits that anybody is capable of having a bath, but still insists on his argument. So then the Buddha goes on again. What do you think, Asalayana? Suppose a head-anointed noble king were to assemble, so head-anointed being the ceremony by which the king is established, the coronation ceremony. So suppose the king were to assemble here 100 men of different birth and say to them, "Come, sirs, let any here who has been born into a noble clan, or a Brahmin clan, or a royal clan, take an upper stick of salawood, salala wood, sandalwood, or padumaka wood, and light a fire and produce heat. Also let anyone who has been born of an outcast clan, a trapper clan, a wicker worker's clan, a cartwright's clan, or a scavenger's clan, take an upper fire stick made from a dog's drinking trough, from a pig's trough, from a dustbin, or from castor oil wood, and light a fire and produce heat. What do you think, Asalayana? When a fire is lit and heat is produced by someone of the first group, would that fire have a flame, a colour and radiance? And would it be possible to use it for the purposes of fire? While when a fire is lit and heat is produced by someone of the second group, that fire would have no flame, no colour, no radiance, and it would not be possible to use it for the purposes of fire. No, Master Gotama. When the fire is lit by someone in the first group or in the second group, it would be possible to use it for the purposes of fire, for all fire has a flame, a colour and a radiance, and it is possible to use all fire for the purposes of fire." So again, quite a strong argument here, and the interesting to notice some of these details. I mean, some of them are fairly obvious in terms of the upper classes, the Kshatriya class, the Brahmin class, the royal class, and these kinds of good wood, the sala tree being the tree under which the Buddha attained parinibbana, so obviously having a kind of sacred connotation. But interesting, some of the lower caste or taboo things. First of all, the outcast is straightforward. The trappers, again, pretty straightforward. Usually the hunters and trappers and things are seen as being fairly low caste because their livelihood comes from killing. And it's also one of the reasons, partly because the livelihood comes from killing, but also because, in a sense, it's an old-fashioned job. Yeah, it's very archaic. Yeah, obviously, modern ways of raising food is through farming. Yeah, in that time, in the time of the Buddha, it was, you know, farming was the thing. And so trappers were kind of out there.
It's also a bit of a structureless job. You just lose the lines of the book. Same book.
Right, I thought that was an interesting one. Wicker workers. Why are wicker workers? What's wrong with wicker workers?
What's a wicker worker?
Someone who makes things like these chairs, weaves the wicker together. Mm-hmm. Like baskets and things? Mm-hmm. Probably mainly baskets, containers.
You've got to kill a lot of plants.
Yeah, but so do farmers. When you harvest the rice, you kill a lot of plants. Yeah, I don't know why this particular clan obviously was considered very low caste. A Cartwright's clan, again, seems a bit strange, doesn't it? I mean, these days, I suppose if you're a mechanic or something like that. Anyway, or a scavenger's clan, it's fairly easy to understand why that would be low caste. Then but then what's wrong with castor oil wood? I only guess castor oil wood maybe not very good wood, I don't know. Okay, so that's that one. I will just check with Analio and see so far how we're going with the other versions. Okay, so both the Madhyama Agama version and the Pali version bring up the practice of loving kindness, which is not found in the individual translation. Okay. And both, all of the versions have the argument about washing, bathing. Then the argument about fire is brought in with in the Pali and the Madhyama Agama counterpart, presumably not the individual translation. Which rather has this argument instead: coming members of the four castes coming close to a fire during the cold season, coming to the conclusion that the fire will warm them all. Okay, so this is not an identical argument, but still a very similar one. Again, remembering that the examples used here are all in this sutta. One of the things about this sutra is that the examples used are all very pertinent to the Brahmanical tradition. And it starts out with the argument about giving birth, so these are like direct arguments and so on. But then when it starts to give the come to one about doing loving kindness, of course this is the Brahma Viharas. Yeah, so in a sense it's saying, can non-Brahmins do the Brahma Viharas? Can they become Brahma? And then the one about bathing, of course, being very pertinent, also bathing, ritual bathing being a very central part of the Brahmanical tradition. And so also the one about fire, because fire worship was very central to the Brahmanical tradition. So the Buddha's choice of similes and arguments here is not at all random. He's in fact choosing quite systematically a series of contexts which are very central to the Brahmanical sense of self-identity. Worship of fire being perhaps the oldest or one of the oldest cultural religious practices. Okay, so then it goes on to another major concern of culture, which is the kinship laws. And this has been a favourite topic of modern anthropologists, especially Levi-Strauss. And the basic idea being that one of the essential structural principles that any human society has evolved is a set of kinship laws, which essentially says, at the most basic level, says who you can sleep with, right? So who you can have sex with and who you can't. So this is the incest taboo. So it's giving grades of and degrees of relationship which structure how families can form. And these rules which have similar things in very widely spread. So for example, incest with close family members is very widely tabooed. But then the other aspects of the kinship laws are very diverse and treated in very, very different ways all around the world, and in ways which sometimes reflect the nature of the society and the different cultural changes that a place is going through. So, for example, sometimes when a couple get married, the husband will go to the wife's family, or sometimes the wife will come to the husband's family, and so on. And that ends up making quite a big difference in how the people live. And so one of the basis of the whole idea of kinship and then becomes the notion of lineage. How do you know that you belong to such and such a family? How do you know that you belong that the kinship laws should apply in such and such a way in your particular case? And so what you see in mythology and folklore and so on is a very, very widespread motif of riddling or playing or questioning with the paradoxes that come from breaching these kinds of boundaries. Yeah, what happens if these things get twisted or turned in one way or the other? And this being a very famous theme in mythology, obviously the most famous version being Oedipus, but being very, very commonly found. And so this is what Levi-Strauss argued in the field of anthropology, is that one of the things that these things do is that they establish, their purpose is to establish, in a sense, difference. Right? So you have to be able to build a society where people are differentiated, people have their own particular roles. And as society becomes more complex, right, you need more differentiation. Okay, if you're in a hunter-gatherer society, it's just got an extended family wandering across the, through the bush, you don't need much differentiation. But once you start settling in villages, farming and so on, you have more and more and more differentiation. So you have to structure society in more and more complex ways. And this, of course, is where the caste system comes from. It's an attempt at structuring society, at creating order. But of course, one of the big problems with that is that you want to create order, but human nature doesn't want to be ordered, does it? Yeah? You want to be able to say a Brahmin and a Kshatriya shouldn't be sleeping together, but there's a nice young Brahmin boy over there and a nice young Kshatriya girl over there, and other things are more important to them than the notions of how to structure the society. So these things, in the same sense, there's these conflicting goals. Yeah, in society, conflicting motives. On the one hand, there's a need to maintain the order and the structure of the society, yeah, and give everybody a place. And it's important for us to remember that even though we criticise, and the Buddha's criticising the caste system, but there is a point to it, yeah, and it was a way of organising a society. Because they didn't have the ways of organising things that we do. You know, they don't have governments in the sense that we do. They didn't have legal structures in the sense that we do. They don't have all of the forms that we have for structuring our society. So this is the kind of thing which they ended up with. And of course, it plays a certain role, but obviously it becomes... the problem is when it becomes stuck and can't change with time. So this is what Levi Strauss pointed out, is that in the mythologies, in the stories, in the rituals, is that it's always playing with these conflicting sets of values. So his notion of a myth was that it was a way where you could sort of make it palatable to have these different values, because you're telling a story where they're represented in different ways. Yeah? And so you can acknowledge the reality of these different conflicting sets of values, and that could always be negotiated within the story, because you can always tell the story in different ways. Okay, so that being quite an influential theory of anthropology. Okay, so here, how does that go in this particular case? What do you think, Athalina? Suppose a noble youth were to cohabit with a Brahmin girl, right? A Kshatriya and a Brahmin girl, a son was born from their cohabitation. Should a son born from a noble, from a Kshatriya youth and a Brahmin girl, be called a noble Kshatriya or a Brahmin after the mother? All right. So does the lineage follow the father or the mother? Yeah? And of course, this being one of the basic notions of folklore is patrilinear descent or matrilinear descent. Yeah? And the answer here, he could be called both. Surprisingly open-minded, really. What do you think, Asalayana? Suppose a Brahmin youth here were to cohabit with a Kshatriya girl and a son were to be born. Should a son born from the Brahmin youth and the noble girl be called a Kshatriya or Brahmin, he could be called both. And, I mean, one of the things this is reflecting, and this is reflected elsewhere in the suttas as well as in the Brahmanical literature, is that our attempts to, you know, to make these clear-cut dividing lines, actually, when you're trying to apply it in practice, it never quite works out as simply as you think. Okay, so then it goes on. What do you think, Asalayana? Suppose a mare were to be mated with a male donkey and a foal were to be born as a result. Should the foal be called a horse or a donkey after the father? And Asalayana says, it's a mule, Master Gotama, since it does not belong to either kind. I see the difference in his last case, but I see no difference in either of the former cases. Okay, so in this case, so the point Asalayana is making is that in this case, it's like a separate class is being produced, mule, which is neither a donkey nor a horse. And we've now run out, unfortunately, of what Google Books is giving us for free. So I'll just read the next page out. What do you think, Asalayana? Suppose there are two Brahmin students who were brothers, born of the same mother, one studious and acute, and one neither studious nor acute. So, yeah, I should just come back to that. I just mentioned that in passing, but I'll just clarify what I meant. In this idea that the caste system is a lot less flexible, sorry, is a lot more flexible in practice than the theory would suggest, is something which is not only found in the Buddhist literature, but also is found in the Brahmanical literature of the same period. And just one of the best examples is the story of a young student called, his name is Satyavati, I think. Satyavati. And he was a young fellow who wanted to go and study. You know, he's brought up by his mother. He didn't know who his father was. Right? And so he wants to go and study with this Brahmin teacher, and he says to his mum, I want to go and study with this Brahmin teacher. And she says, well, that's good. And he says, but you have to tell me who my father was, so, because they're going to ask me who my father was. And she says, well, you know, son, how things are, and I got around a bit when I was a young woman, and things happen, and I don't actually really know who your father is. And so he and this is in the Upanishads, in the Brahmanical literature. Yeah? And then he goes to see the teacher, and the teacher, he says, I want to be a student. The teacher says, that's very good. He says, well, so what's your lineage? Who's your father? He says, well, my mum said she doesn't really know who the father was. And he says, and the teacher's response was, only a true Brahmin could have spoken in that way. Yeah? You've got such a regard for truth. You're not trying to lie. You're not trying to conceal anything. You must be a Brahmin. Yeah. And that's what the Brahmin scriptures are saying. Yeah? So this argument which the Buddha is making is not, it's not only a Buddhist argument, it's also being made a similar way in the Brahmanical literature. Also, the other thing which is very important to notice, and which was only brought out and noticed in the modern times by the Western scholars, you see, in the Brahmanical tradition, as they depict themselves, it's always like the Brahmins have maintained this sort of knowledge from time immemorial and so on and so on and so forth. But actually, what they started to notice when they looked in the dialogues, especially in the Upanishads, is that the actual philosophical discourses and many of the main doctrines that we associate with the higher philosophy of Hinduism, sort of the non-dual philosophies and things like that, most of them are actually introduced by Kshatriyas in the Upanishads themselves. Yeah, so you have these dialogues where the Brahmins come and have discussions with the Kshatriya, with the king or something like that, and the Brahmin gives a discussion, a dialogue on Brahma, and the king says, I'm not satisfied with that, that's only a shallow interpretation, and then proceeds to give a much more profound interpretation of what Brahma is. Again, in a manner very, very similar to what's happening in the suttas, where the Buddha as a Khatriya is trying to give a more spiritual and more profound notion of what Brahma is to the Brahmins. But so the extraordinary thing is that that same thing is preserved within the Brahmanical literature itself. So, okay, so here we go. So two brothers, born of the same mother, one studious and acute, one neither studious nor acute. Which one would the Brahmins feed first, at the funeral feast, or at a ceremonial milk rice offering, or at a sacrificial feast, or at a feast for guests? Well, on such occasions, said Asalayana, Brahmins would feed first the one who is studious and acute, Master Gotama. For how could what is given to one who is neither studious nor acute bring great fruit? So what do you think, Asalayana? Suppose there were two Brahmin students who were brothers, born of the same mother, one studious and acute, one immoral and of bad character. Sorry, one studious and acute, but immoral and of bad character. And one neither studious nor acute, I mean acute here meaning intelligent, but virtuous and of good character. Which one would you feed first? And he says, on such occasions, we would feed first the one who was virtuous, even if he wasn't learned and intelligent. Okay, for how could what is given to one of him who is immoral and bad character bring great fruit? So then the Buddha said, first, Asalayana, you took your stand on birth, and after that you took your stand on scriptural learning, and after that you've come to take a stand on the very ground that purification is for all the four castes as I describe it. So the Buddha is now bringing it all back home and not letting him get away with it. When this was said, the Brahmin student Atulayana sat silent and dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum and without response. So, poor old Atulayana. Okay, so the two additional arguments given here. In the both Chinese discourses, the Buddha asks Atulayana, if only Brahmins were not obstructed by empty space, or if the same applied to all castes. Huh. Are only Brahmins are not obstructed by empty space, or if the same applies to all castes? Fascinating argument, isn't it? I mean, it's also related to Brahmanical doctrines. The notion of space is an important philosophical notion in the Upanishads. One of the teachings being that you know, what is space? That it's Brahman who is space, or is woven into space. Space is woven out of Brahman. The individual translation, moreover, proposes that any members of any caste will be able to cross a river with the help of a boat, not only Brahmins. And once again, the example being obviously a spiritual metaphor. Three versions agree on taking up the caste of a child born from a couple of mixed castes, with one marriage partner from the warrior caste and the other partner from the Brahmin caste. According to the Pali account, Asalayana replied that the child could belong to either the father's caste or the mother's caste. In the Madhyama Agama version, Asalayana indicated that even resemblance with the mother or father would not suffice to decide if the child belongs to the caste of one of the parents. And according to the individual translation, he simply admitted that he did not know to which caste the child would belong. Okay, and they all use the simile of the mule, which is neither a horse nor a donkey. The same dilemma, together with the mule simile, occurs also in the Akotara Agama, in its parallel to the Sela Sutta, which we read over the last class. Akotara Agama presentation differs insofar as it suggests that a child from a couple of mixed Brahman and warrior descent would invariably belong to the caste of the father. The same problem recurs also in the Ambatta Sutta, according to which a child from a Brahmin and a warrior couple would be acceptable to Brahmins, while the same is not the case with the members of the warrior caste, as they would not give such a child consecration. Along similar lines, the Dirgha Agama, parallel to the Ambatta Sutta, indicates that the warriors would not respect a child from a Brahmin father and a warrior mother and would not consider it a rightful heir, while the Brahmins would respect a child from a warrior father and a Brahmin mother, and would consider it as a rightful heir. The different opinions proposed in these texts show the Buddha had indeed taken up a tricky subject, which, however, in all versions did not yet convince Asalayana to give up his attempt to establish caste superiority by right of birth. So, and just to read here a note from a discussion of the caste system in ancient India, when a male of the higher caste marries a woman of a lower caste, the marriage and the offspring are said to be anuloma, in the natural order. So if the man is a high caste and the woman's a low caste, if there is a woman in the higher caste and a man in the lower, then the child is said to be pratiloma, against the natural order. She explains that while there are different opinions on whether an anuloma child deserves to be reckoned as a member of the father's caste, which we've seen above in the Buddhist sources, the pratilomas are lower in status than any of the two parents, a bit like the mule. Applied to the present dilemma, suggests that a child born from a couple where the father caste is superior to the mother, the child might be reckoned the same caste as its father, or else might only receive the inferior caste status of its mother. A child from a father of inferior caste, however, would not seem to stand any chance of becoming a member of the higher caste of its mother. So obviously it's very complex, and obviously the fact that all of the sources we've got here give slightly different versions of what's happening shows it's probably very realistic. There probably were slightly different versions of these things being applied all over the place. Certainly there's not one monolithic solution to these problems, and I'm sure if a detailed study of the Brahmanical scriptures would reveal variations within them, but also to remember that those scriptures are a bunch of old men trying to tell young people what to do. They're not a description of what's actually happening, right? They're a description of what they would like to happen. Yeah? So it's not necessarily the actual situation would be much more complex. And one of the dynamics here, which I just mentioned in passing, is that, of course, you know, Brahmanical society is a patriarchal society, so the men want to get the power for themselves, and they want to say, you know, it should be patrilineal, it should be the father who determines everything, right? Yeah. So this is the thing. But there's a huge problem with that. There's a practical problem, is that you can never really determine who the father is, right? Obviously, you know who the mother is of the child, but you never really know who's the father, right? And so the question of the knowledge of paternity is a major, major problem. And it's one of the major reasons why, in cases like that, as with the Satyavati case, that, you know, the mother just didn't know who the father was. In that case, she genuinely didn't know, but of course, in many cases, she'd know very well who the father was, but she's not saying, right? But still you have to, in some sense, maintain the notion of lineage. So you might not know who the father was, but somehow they have to belong to some kind of family. So how do you do that? So that's where it would tend to come back to the mother's lineage. Yeah? So these things are always very, very complex.
Okay, one question.
Yeah.
Could it be that the mother was trying to protect her son by telling him that she doesn't know who the father is?
Could be, yeah. Maybe she knew that he was a low caste or something like that.
So it doesn't mean that she's really low.
Quite possible, yeah. I hadn't thought of that, yeah.
Speak often the decision can have a breach of the parent style.
Exactly. Or on all of the other factors which would play in, how intelligent the person is, how much money is involved,
yeah.
Or all kinds of things, yeah. And that would certainly bias the argument one way or another. Okay, so the Madhyama argument also gives the argument about the two Brahmin brothers not found in the similar argument, not found in the individual sutta. The response to the argument when the Buddha says that you've been defeated, then Asalayana in the Pali remains silent, but in the Madhyama Agama version, Asalayana got up and paid respects to the Buddha, causing the audience to be struck by wonder and express their admiration for the Buddha's might and power. That kind of detail being very characteristic of the Madhyama Agama, that it tends to sort of be a step further along that road of having a few more miracles and wonders and sort of praising the Buddha in any situation, rather than the Pali, which is just a little bit less along that road, and a little bit more kind of restrained and realistic in its depictions as a generalization. Okay, so now we have the interesting story of the meeting between the seer Asita Devala and the seven Brahman rishis. Okay, so this particular story starts out Bhuta Pubbam, which is the Pali idiom for once upon a time. Okay, so you always find that in the Jatakas and everything. So Bhuta Pubbam, once upon a time, there were seven Brahman rishis. Of course, it's been very interesting because the seven sages, the seven isis, in Sanskrit rishi, in Pali isi, is a very famous and important part of the Brahmanical mythology, sort of the seven rishis, seven sages, being born very early on in the cosmology. And Kashyapa being one of them, and the seven sages being found elsewhere in Aryan mythology. So it's probably an old Indo-European motif of some sort, possibly relating to perhaps to the originally to the seven planets, perhaps seven sages, like the sages as the lights. But anyway, so we have the story of seven Brahmanical rishis. Missing the first part of it is missing on this version, but I'll just read the first part. Once upon a time, Asalayana, when seven Brahman seers were consulting together in leaf huts in the forest, this pernicious view arose in them. Brahmans are the highest caste, and so on. Now the seer Devala the Dark heard this. Okay, so Devala the Dark, little footnote here. saying that Devala the dark was identified in the commentary as being the Buddha in an earlier life, of course. Not sure if we know anything else about him. So the word for dark here is asita. Then he arranged his hair and beard, dressed in ochre-coloured garments. Kesamasum kapetva. So kesamasum kapetva, arranged his hair and beard. Manjitavanani dusani nivasetva. Oh, interesting. Normally they use the ochre as the translation of kasaya, being the colour of the robes. And very commonly found in that sense. But here we have manjita. Manjita meaning usually translated as crimson. So red robes rather than ochre coloured robes, perhaps. Put on stout sandals, banaha, and taking a staff made of gold, jata rupa mayang dandang. And of course, these being characteristics of rishis down to the present day in India, the staff carried by the Shiva devotees. He appeared in the courtyard of the seven Brahman seers. The word for appeared, paturahosi, is usually used of somebody who disappears with their psychic powers and then reappears. Not clear in this case whether that's what's meant. Then while walking up and down the courtyard of the seven Brahman seers, the seer Devala, so he was Chankamano, doing walking meditation in the courtyard, and he said this: where have those worthy Brahman seers gone? Where have those worthy Brahman seers gone? And they thought, who is walking up and down in the courtyard of the seven seers like a village lout speaking so loudly? Yes. Handanuko. I'm just trying to find what the word is for village lout. It's Handa. Gamandala rupo. This is the ancient Pali word for a bogan. I have here. Who are these bogans driving their cars, pumping out the music? Gamandala rupo. I have to look that up afterwards. Like a Gamandala Rupa. Gama is a village. Mandala. Okay, so like a bogan. So they said, let's curse him, Abhi Sapama. Now, and this being kind of standard thing that Brahmins do all the time, is go and cursing people. It's a standard motif in all of the mythology and so on, is you have to be very scared of doing anything to nasty to Brahmins because they might curse you, right? And so this is, again, we were talking about this a little bit yesterday, this notion of the sacred and the profane, and like the taboo and the holy are actually two sides of the same thing, right? And it's the same thing with Buddhist monks and nuns today, that you know, in a sense, we're regarded as sacred, yeah? So we're in a kind of sacred space related to the lay people. And so, you know, that's always like, there's a kind of, so that side, there's a notion of respect, right? So there's a kind of respect and devotion and love. But the flip side of that is also the fear, because lay people also have a lot of fear. Like if they say anything bad about the monks and nuns or do anything wrong, then they'll make a lot of bad karma, yeah, and go to hell. So it's also, you're also very dangerous, yeah? So you've got this kind of charged atmosphere notions of both devotion and danger always come hand in hand. Yeah.
I mean, if this was the fear in the lay people, why is it that during the Buddha's time the laity were able to complain to the Buddha about the behavior of the venerable?
Well, that's true, yeah.
And so was how the Vinaya came about?
That's true, yeah.
Yeah.
So obviously it wasn't felt in that way at that time, for sure. Yeah. It is these days, but. Well, there could be something to that, yeah.
I think it's the case that we see the monks behaving and preventing the streets from being complained about.
Yeah.
Then why is it no longer a mother?
He's no longer sacred, and therefore no longer taboo, and therefore no longer dangerous. Yeah. It's only as long as they've still got the power.
Actually, yeah? All life's no longer sacred.
Yeah. In Ipoh, when I was there, there was a story of a monk who'd been staying there a couple of years earlier, and one of the caves in Ipoh was near to a train line. You had to cross over the train tracks to get to the cave, and go through some bush and stuff, and then just walk across. And the cave was quite coveted for various reasons. People like the caves around there. They do various things in there. You can set up gambling dens and illegal liquor, and you can store things and various kinds of things. So this place was next to, there was this local villagers or people in the area were not very moral, so they had a lot of problems, and continual problems in that cave. You know, they stole the Buddha image, they kept on breaking in, they had to build bigger walls and so on and so forth, a bit like a fortress these days. Eventually they cemented the Buddha image in, so no one could steal it anymore. But it was a Buddha with the Mucha Linda, with the Naga coming up, so they came and they hacksawed the Naga serpent off the back of it. They stole the water pump for the cave, and all of these kinds of things were happening. And once this kind of got bad, and the monk who was there, it was a Chinese Malaysian monk, he's disrobed now, but he went and tried to speak to them about it, you know, in one of the local coffee shop or wherever these guys used to hang out, and say, you know, please, you know, please leave us alone, we're just trying to do our meditation and blah blah blah, and you know, and they got really angry with him and were kind of yelling, and you know, and he said, well, listen, you guys, he said something like, you know, you're going to regret it or something like that. Don't know exactly what he said. And then he went off and then went back to the cave that night. The guys had been drinking, and then one of them decided to really go and show him a lesson and get his revenge on this evil monk. And he's drinking, and he collapsed on the train line and got run over by the train and got killed. Yes. So they never bothered the monk after that. You know, that's a very powerful monk. Don't do anything to upset him. Venerable, oh, good to see you. Please come. So this notion of cursing. Right. So they cursed him. They cursed Siddhartha the dark. Thus, be ashes, vile one. Be ashes, vile one. But the more the seven Brahman seers cursed him, the more comely, beautiful and handsome the seer Devala the Dark became. Then the seer, they thought, our asceticism is in vain, our holy life is fruitless. For formerly, when we cursed anyone thus, be ashes, vile one, be ashes, vile one, he always became ashes. But the more we curse this one, the more comely, beautiful and handsome he becomes. It gives an interesting perspective on, you know, what you think the whole fruits of the holy life are. Yeah, we just read the Samadhipa. Palace for third, you know, there's certain aims to which Buddhists practice the holy life. Obviously, they had a different set of aims, yeah. And the curse here is basma vasalahohi, basma vasalahohi, yeah, basma vasalahohi, basma vasalahohi. See, it's the same grammatically, it's a similar form. Using the hohi form is like you use suki hotu or something like that. It's the same form as we use the blessings in Buddhism. Again, this idea that sacred and profane are the same thing. Grammatically, we say the same thing. You know, suki hotu, suki hohi. Suki hohi is the same form. Basma. I love that word. It's a good word, isn't it? Basma. Be ashes. Basma. Anyway, I like it. Okay. Your asceticism is not in vain. When they say in vain, the word is moghang, watano, tapo. Tapas is vain. Mogha. Your asceticism is not vain, sirs, your holy life is not fruitless, but sirs, put away your hatred against me. We have put away our hatred against you, manopadosa. Who are you? Have you heard of the seer Devala the dark, sirs? Yes, sir, then I am he. Then the seven Brahman seers went to him and paid homage. And he said to them, "Sirs, I've heard that while the seven Brahman seers were dwelling in leaf huts in the forest, this pernicious view arose in them. Brahmans are the highest caste and the heirs of Brahma. That is so, sir. But, sirs, do you know if you, the mother who bore you went only with a Brahman and never with a non-Brahman?" "Well, no, sir." "But, sirs, do you know if your mother's mothers back to the seventh generation went only with Brahmins and never with non-Brahmins?" "Well, no." "Now, do you know if your father only went with a Brahmin good woman and never with a non-Brahmin woman?" "Well, no." "And if your father's father's back to seventh generations?" "No, sir." So again, this is showing this notion of lineage. And the same thing applies, I mean, you know, in the Buddhist notion of lineage, in the Vinayas and things like that, you know, we have a very attached to XYZ lineage and we're the Tibetan lineage and we're the Theravadan lineage and everything like that. But, well, do you know, you know, seven generations back, what the lineage was, what they were doing? We have no idea. Yeah? In fact, the notion of lineage, in a Vinaya sense, is just as complex as the physical lineages we're talking here. In fact, quite possibly more so. At least now we can do DNA testing, right? But we can't do DNA testing for ordination lineages. And so these notions are really, you know, just as arbitrary as anything else, you know.
Interesting. If you want to enter the SS on Hitler, you have to prove that your family was only German for seven generations.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you need to get the proof in one day.
Huh.
Otherwise they won't take you up, because you weren't pure enough.
Hmm.
Just
mustn't be easy to get that evidence.
Yeah. Seven generations. Interesting.
Yeah.
Why is it seven?
Well, very important symbolically. I mean, for many reasons, but I think the most basic reason that I mentioned briefly before is because of the seven planets in the sky. It's actually five visible planets and the sun and the moon, so they were counted as the seven planets, and so then that connects it then with astrology, and then the weeks, so then it connects with the weeks, and of course then you have the 4 weeks and the month and so on. So I suspect that that's the most basic, because you very often find the number seven in cosmic contexts. So there's like the seven mountain systems of mountains around Mount Meru, or like the 7 days of creation and these kinds of things. So it's very often when it has that cosmic significance, that's a cosmic number, then usually the ideas of cosmology are just derived from the stars. Yeah. So this is why I think that would be the most, I suspect the most basic meaning of it. So it has that kind of idea of the whole cycle in the seven, like crossing over the seven things, like the Buddha took seven steps after he was born, yeah, to symbolise crossing over the cycles of birth, ageing and death. Okie dokie. So, sirs, and this other bit, also the next bit quite interesting. Sirs, do you know how the descent of an embryo comes about? Sirs, we do know that. So this is the conception. They use the word descent as being a unfortunately, over-literal word. The Pali word is avakanti. Ava meaning down, kanti meaning go, so literally descent, but obviously far too literal. It just means the conception of the embryo. So we know how the conception of the embryo comes about. Here there is the union of the mother and the father. The mother is in season and the Gandhaba is present. Thus the ascent of an embryo comes about through the union of these three things. So the note here, 875, okay. So I'll just finish this and then come back to talk more about it. Then says, do you know for sure whether that Gandhaba is a noble, a Brahman, or a merchant, or a worker? Sir, we do not know for sure whether that Gandhaba is a noble, a Brahman, a merchant, or a worker. That being so, sirs, then what are you? That being so, sirs, we don't know what we are. That's good, yeah? A little ignorance is always a good thing. So, this argument, of course, is a very well-known one in Buddhism in discussions of rebirth and so on, but almost always it's quoted from the Mahādhammā Saṅkhaya Sutta, where it's presented in the context of dependent origination, and it's presented as a Buddhist theory, and it's almost entirely neglected, this particular passage, where it shows that actually it's a Brahmanical theory. And like so many of the teachings in Buddhism, the Buddha adopted those things from Brahmanism which he believed or accepted and had no problem with adopting them. Of course, he didn't adopt them uncritically. As we see here, he's criticizing the Brahmins through the whole thing. But there were certain ideas which he did accept, and this being one of them. So here there is the union of the mother and the father. The mother is in season and the Gandhaba is present. So what we're talking about here is just to notice a number of things, how the conception happens. The first thing is that there's multiple conditions at work here. All right. So again, this comes back to that notion of karma. Yeah. So we have the notion of karma, and very often in Buddhism people think that, you know, everything comes because of your karma. But where the Buddha explained causality, there are actually many different kinds of conditions. Yeah? Karma is a relevant condition, but it's not the only condition. Yeah? And so the union of mother and father, mother is in season, and the Gandhaba is present. And obviously there are other factors as well. This just being a list of three necessary conditions and many others.
What's the Gandhaba?
That's what I'm just going to come to next. So the Gandhaba is, again, a very interesting term. Normally, Gandhaba in Buddhism means a celestial musician. Okay, so they were the guitar players in the heaven. And the most characteristic story there is the story in the Sakapanha Sutta, where Panchasikha, the Gandhaba, comes and plays an erotic love song to the Buddha as a way of getting his attention. Yeah. My love for the divine maiden Surya Vachasara is like the love that the Arahants have for the Dhamma. Oh maiden, fair of thighs, I am intent on you as the Buddha was intent on enlightenment and striving beside the marriage. So, this is... Well, maybe he wasn't, you know, maybe he wasn't doing a jhana or something. Maybe he was doing some other kind of meditation.
But then the other Brahman couldn't come to the Buddha. They need to send him to sing the song to Buddha. I mean, I have some questions about that.
Well, I'm sure it would. I mean, surely it would attract. It would attract my attention.
In Somali.
So that's the kind of the cliched idea of what a Gandhaba is, yeah? It's a celestial musician who's very sensuous, playful, and so on. And here we seem to have a completely different idea of a Gandhaba, as in some way associated with the notion of rebirth. Now here the Gandhaba clearly doesn't mean that particular class of celestial beings, because it says, well, it was in the past life a noble, a Brahmin, a merchant, or a worker. So it's obviously connected with a human rebirth in some sense in the past, and seems to mean something like the spirit or the soul or something like that. You know, is just what takes rebirth and what was that in its past life. We don't know where that spirit or that soul comes from. And again, this being a very genuine problem in the Brahmanical theory, because on the one hand they're developing a practical social structure based on the four castes and saying, you know, we know who belongs to which caste and we know what your role is and what your place is and so on and so forth. On the other hand, so that's a very worldly and pragmatic teaching, but on the other hand they're developing a spiritual teaching about rebirth and the soul and the self and so on, and meshing those two is not easy at all. Yeah, because if you want to say, well, you know, you have an eternal soul whose essence is the same as Brahma, your cosmic Brahman, then how do you mesh this with the notion of caste? So this being one of the major philosophical problems in Brahmanism and later on in Hinduism. So we have this interpretive problem, and this being one interpretive problem which we can't actually solve from the Buddhist texts, the reason being that we just have this couple of references to the Gandhaba in this sense, and then the reference to the Gandhaba in as the celestial musician, and this doesn't seem to be very much that can unite the two notions. So there was a wonderful study by Vijayasekara in his book, I think, Pali and Vedic Studies, or Buddhist and Vedic Studies, which is a fantastic collection of essays, published about 50 years ago or so. And he's one of the very few scholars who's equally well-versed in Buddhist and Vedic ideas. And he has got a very interesting article in there about on this exactly this question, and he shows that the Gandhaba is actually mentioned widely in different senses in the Brahmanical literature, having a general notion of something like the English notion of a spirit, but having both of these kinds of connotations, in one sense being that's the spirit that's passed on from one life to another, but in another sense being a spirit as a celestial being. And it has this kind of a variety of uses, and you can see the relationships and connections through the different uses in the Brahmanical literature, which you can't from the Pali. It doesn't have enough context to be able to work it out. But also showing that the notion is quite old, related perhaps to an idea of a horse deity in the past, and also perhaps being related to the Western notion of the centaur. Yeah, because the centaur in Greek pronunciation or something would be Kantaura, which is not very different from Gandharva being the Sanskrit pronunciation. Yeah, Gandharva and Kantaura, quite similar. And so he suggested this was an old Indo-European notion of rebirth in some sense. So well worth having a look at that article if you're interested to know more about Gandhabas, and also a fantastic article about Gapiyan Karohi, which is also really worth, if you've ever wondered why we ritually murder our fruit for the meal, then.
Is there a question?
Yeah.
This Gandhaba thing, is the Tibetan reference to Garo State and the reference to the Indian Johnson also similar to this Gandhaba state of being?
Yeah. Yes, that's this. I mean, this particular context is a bit vague, it's not so specific, but it would seem to, you know, seem to have an idea of like a sort of a being, in a sense of sort of a movement between one state or another rather than instantaneous rebirth, but it's not really clear enough. But yeah, you're quite right, it does relate to that classic controversy about the instantaneous rebirth versus the process of rebirth that's taught in most schools. And this particular passage is one of those which is quoted in the discussions, yeah, to show that in the Pali canon that it seems that they acknowledge a sort of more of a process of rebirth, as was described in more detail in the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Bardo states and so on. Yeah, it's one of the things I think which is unfortunate about Theravada, because they excluded this notion of the in-between state, so there's nothing really, it doesn't really say anything, have anything to say about it. Whereas actually in the Sarvastivadins, they had a lot of very interesting things to say about the in-between state and the process. A lot of those ideas in the modern Tibetan and so on are actually originally from the Sarvastivada, because they accepted the idea of an in-between state. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Okay, that being so we don't know what we are. Natmayang evang sante bho natmayang janama ke mayang homa. That being so, we don't know what we are. I think it's true. I just want to kind of linger on that a little bit. This being such, good sir, we don't know what are we. So this being a very positive outcome to a spiritual discussion. But you can see how this works, because you know there's the whole idea. You know, in Buddhism we have the idea of not self, right? And this idea of not self, and we want to say. And in Buddhism we always say, oh, that the Hindus or the Brahmins teach the self, which of course they do, right? But it's a little bit more nuanced than that, because these guys thought they knew who they were, right? They thought they had an idea of what they thought that their self was. They identified with this caste. They identified with their notion as Brahmanical rishis. They think we're good ascetics, we're sages. See, we can prove it. Basma vasala. They can turn you into ashes, right? But now they don't know who they are. Yeah. So this is part of their spiritual evolution. Yeah. This kind of false notion of the self has been discarded. And they're quite open now. This is this kind of state, they're kind of hovering. Well, we don't know anymore. We thought we knew. Yeah? And so this is where the potential for growth always comes from. So now, Asalayana, even those seven Brahman seers, on being pressed and questioned and cross-questioned by the seer Devala the Dark on their own assertion about birth, were unable to support it. But how shall you, on being pressed and questioned and cross-questioned by me, now on your assertion about birth, be able to support it? You who rely on the teacher's doctrines are not even fit to be their spoon holder, Purna. Ooh, ow. Ooh. So he's sort of rubbing it in there a little bit. Acharyako, so relying on the teacher's doctrines, the Acharya's doctrines. But it's a slightly curious little sage sort of saying at the end, Na puno dabi gaho. Yesang tuang. Yeah. Yesang tuang. I'm not quite sure what the sense of it. I mean, Bhikkhu Bodhi's given a translation here. He's put a bit of explanation in there and so on. The commentary says that the Purna was their servant who looked after their kitchen and used to collect leaves in his spoon or something like that, and they weren't even as good as that. I'm not convinced, and I'm not quite sure what the actual structure there is. Let's see if there's any enlightenment shown on that from the Chinese versions. So Lasanayana Sutta and the Chinese parallels have the individual translation agrees with the Pali commentary in identifying the seer Asita Devala as a former life of the Buddha, making this a Jataka story, if it's correct. The same view so the story of the Asalayana and the Asita and the Brahman seers is also found in other places. In particular in the Ekotara Agama, where it has the same similar story, but the wrong view is a different kind of wrong view, which is that by undertaking asceticism, by tapas, they'll be able to reach kingship in earth or in heaven. And Analia notes, it's quite notable how this Ekotara Agama discourse, as well as another Ekotara Agama discourse, 49.6, which was relevant in the context of the Sela Sutta, combine elements of Majjhima 93, the Asalayana Sutta, with material found in quite different discourses in the Pali Nikayas. Okay, so that the Ekotara Agama is taking stories and elements from different places in the Pali Nikayas and then recombining them to form arguments, similar arguments, but on different topics. So it's a bit of a controversy here that Abhi Horner and Malala Sekara suggest that Asita Devala should be identified with Kala Devala, Kala also meaning dark or black, so it's basically the same name, the Jataka tale in number 43, one of the Jatakas, but this would contradict with the notion that he was the Buddha in his past life. As in the Kala, that Jataka Kala Devala was one of the students of the former of the Bodhisattva, well, not the Bodhisattva himself. So, so the Chinese versions don't have the bit about them feeling that their asceticism is in vain because they can't curse properly. And in the Madhyama Agama version, when he revealed his identity, the seers asked him to forgive them. He didn't realize he was a well-known seer. Okay. Slightly different case in the Madhyama Agama version. Even though the Brahmins felt sure of their purity of descent from the mother and father for up to seven generations, so there they really did feel that they knew their mother and father, the parents, up to seven generations, but they were still unable to indicate to which caste the being to be born belonged. Okay, so they knew their mother and father, but they didn't know the identity of the Gandharva. So that's also quite interesting. And it's not, that's not that's not as difficult as it might sound, because the in India they always have kept for a long time very detailed, for this precise reasons we've been talking about, but they've kept very detailed memory, like a cultural memory of everybody, their kinship relationships, their family and their descent and their lineage and these kinds of things. So people often would know their lineage. It was encoded in names, and there's also very specialists who would know all these things. So there's certain group of people who would just know all the lineages of the people in the area, and you can consult with them, and they'd know everybody and who was married to who and all the relationships. The individual translation also adds that while the child is growing in the womb, the parents are unable to know if it will be blind, deaf or dumb, if it's going to be hunchbacked or lame. If they don't even know this much, how could they claim to know it's come from Brahma's mouth? Fair enough. The Pali version concludes that... so there's nothing about the Gandharva here. Okay. And the conclusion, while the Pali version... So in the Pali version, the... we're looking for the Puna, spoon holder Puna. No. Nothing about the spoon holder Puna. Okay, well, the Pali version concludes by reporting that Asalaina took refuge as a lay disciple. According to the Chinese versions, he only paid his respect. Madhyama Agama version also describes how other Brahmins criticized Asalaina for having been worsted by the Buddha instead of upholding their claim to caste superiority. Bit unfair, and he warned them beforehand, but anyway. So as usual, we find that the teachings, the actual doctrine that's been taught about during the sutta, has minor variations between the different versions, but the variations don't affect the doctrine at all, but quite different in terms of the outcome of the discourse, that as usual the stories of who became a monk or who became converted or who became enlightened or whatever are very different in all of the different versions. Okay. So, this being the Asalaina Sutta. Right, that's it. That's all I got. Anyone got any questions? All good jokes on here. Yeah.
Is it it wasn't just the Brahmins who were twice born, was it?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, the Brahmins, usually the three higher castes, Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and it's a bit of controversy about that as well. Yeah, because they're felt to be born from, you know, the different parts of Brahma, not necessarily from his mouth. But that was actually the topic of a seminar I was in Sydney just recently, and it seems that the notion of twice born is actually quite a late one, and is not actually found in the Pali canon or in any early Brahmanical literature. And there's quite a precise. When the word twice born is found, but it's always used in the early Pali literature just to mean a bird, or similar, you're born from an egg. The meaning in terms of a Brahman is later, and its usage sort of goes fairly systematically up through the different strata of Brahmanical literature, so it's one way you can use for dating. Yeah.
So it wouldn't make out any relevance to, because it wasn't discussed specifically Brahmins anyway, and it's an example of being sort of related to spiritual life.
Yeah. I mean, you could bring it in there, but yeah, there were more. I mean, that doctrine is more for establishing the difference between the regular caste and the outcasts, you know, rather than the thing. And it's interesting that the system is actually not that dissimilar to the class system in medieval Europe. You know, feudal Europe actually had basically the same system. You know, you had the priestly caste and the priestly ones, and then the knights. You know, with the Kshatriyas, and then the merchants, and then the workers and farmers. So, okay. So let's finish my bangs bits.
Thank you.